Alexander Shmerkovsky was fiercely determined to be the fittest of the fit. Desperate times called for desperate measures. Among countless tales of borderline danger and risk of legal consequences, one stood out in particular. My father probably would not want me to tell this story, but I just have to portray the extremes he went to in order to keep our family afloat. Somehow, Pops and his cousin found out that in Poland, there was a shortage of big industrial scales, the kind that weighs slabs of beef at meatpacking plants. The contraptions were going for the equivalent of $100 a pop in Warsaw. That's where the demand was, and my father looked around at Jessa and discovered a source of supply close at hand. He and his cousin went to the town's central market after it closed for the night, bribed the sole security guard with a bottle of vodka, and grabbed all the scales they could, 10 of them, as many as they could squeeze into a borrowed compact car. They drove the stolen trove to Poland and sold it off for $1,000. They then bought as many Levi jeans as they could and drove back to Odessa to flip the merchandise. From very early on, that kind of hustle was in me. It was like a heritage passed down from my father and grandfather. I was not scared. I would not back down. The hustle was in me because my father was in me, and I sure didn't want to apologize for that. I refused to judge him. It was never my place within the family to question anything my parents did. When I was a kid, their favorite phrase was, "Who asked you?" which in Russian was, "Кто тебя спрашивает?" The phrase had pretty much the same nuance in Russian as it did in English, and it would haunt me every time I sat down at the table. "Mom, I don't want to eat borscht." "Oh," she would say, "А кто тебя спрашивает?" "Mom, I don't want to practice the violin." "Кто тебя спрашивает?" "I don't want to wear these hand-me-down clothes." "Кто тебя спрашивает?" Or whatever the issue in question, it was an automatic, universal response to any complaint. Кто тебя спрашивает? Who asked you, little one? My folks have never understood the common American practice of parents becoming pals with their children. There was a distance between us that was filled with love, a distance that basically turned into bottomless respect as I grew older. The distance might have been based a little bit on fear, too. But it also bred a rock-hard sense of accountability. I was held responsible. I never wanted to disappoint or hurt my parents, who had given me so much. I didn't want to disappoint my father, didn't want to anger my mother. That's why later in life, one of the greatest moments came when I realized I had become friends with my dad. It's when I finally knew I was an adult. My mom had just as much steel in her as my dad, but she hid it under a warmer, softer exterior. She was the quiet storm in our household. I have her borscht in my blood. She doesn't get credit for anything when she should get credit for everything. Literally everything. My mom is the type of person who had never made it about her. She was never front and center. That was her complexity and that was her insecurity. But she was always there for us. The steadfast anchor that my father, Max, and I depended upon. Her biggest fear was that the shadowy, illegal world of Odessa hustle would somehow take over our lives. That and the army. Somebody once said that the time not to become a parent was 18 years before a war, and in Ukraine the prospect of war lurked everywhere, all the time. The authorities required all males to register for military service at age 16. The possibility of her sons being gobbled up by the army in Ukraine really frightened my mom. Her youngest brother had served in Afghanistan when the Soviets were there. He saw his best friend die in his arms, and he returned to civilian life a shattered man. My parents might have been the sun and the moon of the family, but there was another planet orbiting around them, a big one, a Jupiter to my Mars, my brother, Max. We are different. That is what people fail to understand when they lump Max and me together as the Shmerkovsky brothers. Our differences do not diminish our deep love and loyalty or interfere in any way with the crazy-ass level of respect I have for my older sibling. In fact, our differences probably only serve to emphasize our brotherly feelings. If we were exactly alike, it would be no big deal to love each other, because it would be like loving a version of ourselves. But to love someone totally different from yourself, that takes strength. Maybe it was because he spent 6 more years growing up in Ukraine than I did, and the experience left a deeper stamp on him, but It is not too much to say that darker currents run through my brother's soul than run through mine. Russian currents. Odessa currents. He was Shakespeare's Hamlet while I was more like Prince Hal. Or to put it more into Russian terms, he was Andre and I was Pierre in Tolstoy's War and Peace. Later on, when they labeled Max as the bad boy of ballroom dance, he didn't object to the bad as much as did to the boy. We're both alphas, and at times having two of us in the same household was like putting two Wolverines in a cage. He's a Capricorn, which is a goat, and I'm an Aries, which is a ram. So my parents had to watch this sheep and goat going at it time and time and time again. But when we weren't fighting, our efforts were channeled in the same direction. Together we were unstoppable. We bulldozed through things. When the direction got muddy and we found ourselves bumping heads, well, it still made for a pretty epic moment. When it comes to the two of us, it has only ever been extremes. Once we moved to the States, I developed a level of American optimism that Max could never fully embrace. My father had a personal brand of optimism too. Not so much hopefulness, but confidence that consistency and hard work would pay off. He believed that as long as you show up and work hard, your minuses would turn into pluses, and success was just around the corner. My brother had a very different kind of optimism that came from a very different place. It was less about entitlement and more of a fundamental demand for fairness. That things should be fair was like his only rule. There might have been a little more arrogance involved in Max's kind of confidence, a brashness and a sense of pride. He was fair but firm, very firm in his expectations. The good life for him represented a delayed payment for the sacrifices he had endured, and he believed he had endured many. But the luxuries that my brother dreamed of simply gave me anxiety. Max's attitude, I paid my motherfucking dues, I deserve what I go after, and I deserve it more than the guy next to me because I've worked harder than the guy next to me. All this is probably Val-style overanalyzing, of course. Really, the main emotion I feel for Max is a ferocious form of gratitude. He blazed my path. I watched him power through life's heartaches and disappointments while I marched behind him, benefiting from the wisdom of hindsight. I was spared a lot of trouble because of all the things I learned from my brother's experience. Then again, I proved from a very early age that I was quite capable of creating trouble all by myself. Odessa. My earliest memories of Odessa, the city in Ukraine where I was born, are of a courtyard. The crumbling old estate house where my family lived had been broken up into apartments after the Russian Revolution, but it featured a central space where kids played and adults gathered to smoke and gossip. We were in courtyard 27, on the corner of Baranova Yartoma, in the center of Odessa. Except for a brief moment when the sun passed over at noon, the courtyard was always in the shade, and I remember it being bathed in a weak green light. Although in reality it was usually overflowing with life, for some reason in my mind's eyes, I always see the big courtyard as deserted, a very romanticized Chernobyl-like scene, straight out of the post-apocalyptic world of Mad Max. In the middle of the space was an abandoned car, a rusted-out Zaporozhets that no one ever drove. It was just there. The Zaporozhets was the Soviet version of an economy compact, a car of the people. Manufactured in Ukraine, the Zappo was a notoriously shitty automobile, a soapbox on wheels. Even so, people had a lot of affection for this poor man's Lamborghini. The broken-down car in the courtyard served as a fitting symbol for the permanently stalled Ukraine economy, in a country that seemed to be just rusting away. But the folks around me growing up were still very much vibrant and alive, and when a car stopped working, it was typical of them to use it as a decoration or a jungle gym for the kids. The courtyard represented a real community, where my neighbors simply laughed at bad luck and trouble. People are what made my young life brighter, not the possessions that they did or didn't have. The surroundings weren't lavish. In fact, they were pretty shitty, but I loved my home, and I was proud of it. I wouldn't want to have grown up in any other place in the world. That paradox, bleak surroundings coupled with a ridiculous sense of pride, is the essence of my childhood. It taught me that circumstances can't break your spirit. In retrospect, I can paint you a picture of a really great time in my life. The world of Odessa might be difficult to grasp for anyone who hasn't experienced it. What outsiders see first is the bleak economic landscape. There was little money around, no jobs, zero opportunity. The streets of Odessa were like a series of dead ends, one after another. And if you traveled down enough of them, cynicism started flowing through your veins. My dad was always hustling, finding any way he could to support his family. For a while, he shuttled back and forth to Turkey, buying Levi denims and leather goods there to sell at the central market back home in Odessa. I grew up in a country where you had to stand online for 5 hours to purchase a piece of chicken, where you were given little ration tickets to pick up a loaf of bread once a week, and where stores would run out of everyday basics all the time. But a child sees life through a different lens. What I saw didn't break me, but simply led me to appreciate my family. I grew up much more preoccupied with people than with possessions. I didn't need a big-ass front yard with a picket fence because I could play with my friends Yura and Andrei. We used our imagination to make the best of what we had. A shitty courtyard? No. A realm of games and magic and joy. The skill of using imagination to transform reality is still incredibly useful to me today. Odessa is the pearl of the Black Sea, a kind of Saint-Tropez made not for billionaires but for commoners, with a beautiful seaside atmosphere and gorgeous women everywhere. Paris might be the city where you fall in love, and New York is the capital of the world, but Odessa is the most charming city in Eastern Europe, with St. Petersburg maybe a close second. The natives know that and believe that, and the pride of Odessans can be intense. In my heart, I have zero loyalty to Ukraine or to Russia, but I was born in an incredible fairy tale of a place, and that's where I'm proud of being from, not a foot outside of the city boundaries. Everyone I had ever met who came from Odessa turned out to be vibrant and interesting. Natives affectionately refer to the place as Odessa Mama, which is also the title of a popular song. In conversation, they will always ask, "Have you been there?" "Oh, you have to go. Man, you have to go. Odessa is the most wonderful place in the world." In the presence of a native, don't ever pronounce it like the town in Texas. Don't say it as though it rhymes with Vanessa, Odessa. Put a little soulful James Brown spin to the middle syllable. Odessa. Like, yeah, sir. Various streets and neighborhoods in the city have completely different flavors. Romanian, Bulgarian, and Turkish influence from the south, Russian or the Caucasus from the north and west. You might even run into a vampire or two from nearby Transylvania. Much of the city's architecture has a very French influence, which gives off a classic stately vibe. Romance is always in the air. The seaside setting adds to the charm, and it is a sea, not an ocean. The Black Sea. Locals are very definite about that. Back then, unless you were some privileged political refugee like Angela Davis, the whole Russian Empire wasn't a popular place to move to as much as a place to escape from. The constant threat of war was one reason. In the past, Odessa had been overrun by Turkish armies, Russian Cossacks, and Nazi stormtroopers. You name it. Till this day, the whole area remains in the middle of a tug of war between Russia and Ukraine. Amid all this history and atmosphere, I took my tiny place in the world on March 24, 1986, officially becoming my parents' problem to deal with. Whether I'm remembering it through the rose-colored glasses of nostalgia or because it really was the pearl of the Black Sea, growing up in Odessa seemed like paradise to me. I guess that unless you've spent your early years abused or starving, all childhood days appear golden in hindsight. The first specific incident I remember took place in Courtyard 27 when I was 5. My brother was playing a Ukrainian kid's game similar to Pogs, the bottle cap game that was so popular in the United States in the mid-1990s. Instead of cardboard milk bottle caps, we played with wrappers of Turbo, a particular brand of gum. The packaging unfolded into little pictures of a Ferrari, a Lamborghini, or some other high-end sports car. Anything but a Zaporozhets. In our eyes, anything foreign was way cooler than anything homegrown. The game was to flatten the gum wrappers out, stack them, then hit the stack with the edge of your palm. As long as your own car landed right side up, you got to collect all the other wrappers that flipped over. We kept going until one player had won all the cars. A simple, mindless game, but one that held endless fascination for us as kids. We were so poor that we couldn't afford to pay attention, as the phrase goes, so we had to make do with what we had, which was countless collections of discarded gum wrappers. But everything is relative, and Turbo was like currency to us. I played as if the stakes were life and death, a little competitor, even as a young kid, already determined to win any contest that came my way. That day I hung on a railing watching my brother play, and this being Ukraine, naturally the railing was broken. On the other side was one-story drop into a concrete basement entranceway, where trash got stacked up to be collected. Max made a sudden move and backed into the broken railing. Like the action in a TV cartoon, the metal railing rebounded and catapulted me into the air. I went sailing, flying headfirst down into a pile of garbage where I crashed onto a box that had a nail sticking out. There was blood, a lot of it. It happened to be my mother's birthday. It's funny how you don't remember all the times of soft kisses, the empty hours, or the safe and secure moments you had as a kid, but the bloody ones always remain sharp in your memory. Having an older brother might have allowed me a little more leeway in the world of mischief, a little larger field of action. In his early teens, Max was already a miniature adult, old beyond his years. I skipped along behind him, always acting out, always curious and outgoing, always tiptoeing on the edge of danger. I was the one who went sailing over the railing. He was the one who walked his bleeding little brother to our mother's birthday party. I was ambitious and very social, while he was way more timid, way more shy. I was the kid who cut up books and set pages on fire under the dinner table while the family sat eating. Max was the one who was reading those books. He was introverted. I was an extrovert. I was also the one who got kicked out of kindergarten after 2 weeks. Kindergarten. How the fuck do you misbehave badly enough to be expelled from kindergarten? I was guilty of multiple offenses. It turned out a pretty long rap sheet for a 5-year-old. I was a little kid decked out in denim head to toe, courtesy of my father's Turkey to Odessa Levi hustle. I thought I was hot shit. During recess one day, the teacher found me swinging on the schoolyard gate, poking my hand out to adults passing by on the sidewalk. Spare change? Spare change, anybody? The school authorities called my mom and pops. Why is your kid begging during recess? Unfortunately for me, my parents had the same question, one that I'd eventually have to explain, either after an inevitable ass-whooping or before. Maybe I had once seen a panhandler on the street somewhere, I don't know. Maybe it was a form of street art for me. At any rate, the incident represented an early introduction to the joys of paid performance. It was also strike one, according to the kindergarten authorities. Strike two came when they found me tying my schoolmates together with their own tights, the long stockings that Ukrainian youngsters traditionally wear. I would pull a kid's tights up from the waistband, stretch them out, and knot them to another kid's before anyone knew what was happening. My poor, innocent schoolmates had never been pranked precisely in that way before. There were tears. Tears also came with strike three, the stunt that got me officially expelled from kindergarten, when I took to speeding on the merry-go-round and, potentially, allegedly, Your Honor, I reserved the right not to incriminate myself. I may or may not have pushed kids off at high velocity. Mr. Chmikovsky, we're afraid that your son Valentin plays too rough with other children. We are going to have to send him home. That was me. I was not the fast and furious, but the fast and the curious. And there was very little logical reason for anything I did. Keep it moving was always my motto. I wasn't a troublemaker, but I was a discoverer of trouble. A busy little man fascinated with adventure. There was something else in my young life besides trouble, though. Just a hint of light amid the doom and gloom backdrop of the Russian soul, like a door cracked slightly open in a prison. Opportunity entered my life around the same time I got expelled from kindergarten. The scar from my fall into the garbage pit probably wasn't yet fully healed. I was riding in the family's beat-up Soviet truck with my father and his cousin Yosik. Like every other adult male relative, we always called him uncle. My uncle Yosik was just out of prison where he had served time for buying items overseas for a certain price and then reselling them in the Soviet Union for a little bit more. A 7-year stretch for embracing the simplest, most fundamental concept of capitalism. What America was built upon landed him in prison in Ukraine. To my young eyes, Uncle Yosik was as cool as Frank Sinatra. Beyond the fact that he had spent time in prison, and prison in the Soviet Union was no joke, he had a flair about him, a charisma that was infectious, a quality that in current slang would be called swag. Uncle Yosik represented the first time I discovered swag in action. He had spent years locked up, but somehow knew his way around the jazz piano, and could wail out on an accordion, too. Riding in the back seat, I didn't have a thought in my head. I was just idly singing along with whatever song was on the radio. A popular Russian rock band, Lube, played its hit tune, Batka Makhno. It was the national reciprocal of U2's Sunday Bloody Sunday, and like much of Soviet rock music those days, the lyrics had a lot of military references. This was during the Russian invasion of Afghanistan, the USSR's version of Vietnam, where the army took a huge hit. The song kicked off with an army trumpet and a gunshot, then segued into a stomping melody that sounded like a group sing-along in a bar. The lead vocalist, Nikolai Rastorguyev, pronounced some dark-ass sentiment somewhere along the lines of, "In Afghanistan, you die slowly alongside your friends." I mean, something like that. I was humming along to lyrics I didn't understand. My uncle turned his head and looked at me, listened for a beat, then nudged my dad. "Hey, he's really got potential," my uncle said. Pop snorted in disbelief. "What? Vale? Potential in singing? Based on what?" In Russian culture, the knee-jerk response was to question everything, always with a slight hint of pessimism. "Yeah, I can hear it," Yosik said. "He has pitch, man." He was singing along in tune. "All right, okay, he has pitch, so what? You should try him out for the music school." My father shrugged him off, going back to worrying about the million other problems he had playing in his mind. If you said music school in Odessa, everyone knew what you were talking about. The National Academy of Music, housed in a beautiful old Beaux-Arts building in the center of town. I always considered Odessa to be the Eastern European equivalent of a New Orleans. There was always a lot of music around, not only classical but also ethnic, pop, and especially jazz. The city was known as the jazz capital of the Soviet Union. The families of George Gershwin and Bob Dylan both emigrated to America from there. A couple of knock-around Odessa dudes driving in an old beater of a truck fantasizing, "You should try him out for music school, man." That would be like two street guys who were living in poverty-stricken existence in the Bronx, say, thinking they could dash out and enroll a kid in a music program. Not just any music program, either. Not something remotely possible, but rather something ultra-prestigious and wildly out of reach, like the disdaining New York fame high school LaGuardia, instead of aiming directly for Juilliard. Why not? Why not upgrade your rust bucket Zaporozhets and not for a Ford, but go all the way for a Bentley? Maybe because it's totally impossible? My father broke his silence. "How would we do this?" he asked my uncle. That moment changed my life. Whatever it is that gives somebody a fresh perspective, that's what makes things happen. That's what sends people on a unique path. Everybody has different perspectives at different times. My dad was a little more cynical in his outlook, maybe because he was preoccupied with scratching out a living for his family. So he didn't even hear my pitch-perfect humming in the back seat. But my uncle did, because he came to it from a perspective that was slightly different from my father's. My father could be forgiven, since it wasn't as if his younger son was singing all day long. In fact, as a kid, I rarely ever sang. From my dad's perspective, I wasn't musical. If anything, my parents were afraid that I was going to end up becoming some sort of extreme sports maniac, a BMX or a motocross rider, something like that, because I hurt myself all the time as a kid, falling off shit, running into things. In that moment, Uncle Yosik could have heard me and said nothing. As rare as talent itself is, I think it's almost as rare for a person to recognize and encourage someone else's talent. But my uncle called me out, and then it became a matter of simple domino effect that happens whenever someone decides to believe in another person. It's why today I instinctively and consciously try to seize every opportunity to encourage someone else to feel as though they can do anything they want to do. Even if they don't wind up pursuing their dream, for a moment they'll feel good because someone else sees possibility in them, just as Uncle Yosik saw possibility in me. The next week, miracles of miracles, my father managed to sign me up for an audition at the Music Academy. My mom dressed me up in the nicest, most formal clothes I had, the outfit I wore whenever there was a formal occasion. I don't remember asking questions. I don't remember getting any answers. That wasn't the way our family worked. As a kid, I was expected simply to show up and take care of business, with no input from yours truly required. We went to the Music Academy as a family, but I had to head into the audition room alone. I'm sure there were plenty of stage parents who drilled and drilled their children for the perfect performance. Pops and my mom were more casual. Here you are. Do your best. Let's see what happens. I met the instructor, a severe woman with hair wrapped so tightly in a bun that it pulled the features of her face backward. Some folks in Beverly Hills would pay top dollar for that kind of skin treatment. She plunked out an A on the piano and nodded at me. I vocalized an A note as best as I could, singing it at the top of my lungs. She sounded a few more notes for me to sing, then cupped her hands and clapped out a rhythm that I had to repeat, which I did precisely. For my grand audition finale, she asked me to sing a song of my choice. So I did the tune that I had hummed along with in the car with my uncle. In Afghanistan, the skies are black with smoke. There I was, belting out lyrics harsh enough to traumatize any kid, with so much heart and conviction that I won the room over and I knew it. The teacher conferred in whispers with a Bolden administrator who had come in while I was singing. Everyone on that faculty looked like what they were, Soviet-era music school teachers. I finished and stood there with a normal 6-year-old's empty expression on my face, like a motel with a neon vacancy sign burning out front. I don't know if they found me comedic, but charisma and a pair of little brass bowls played a big role, since I definitely wasn't the most talented kid auditioning that day. Miss Hairbun spoke some more to Boldy, then turned to me. "What instrument would you like to play?" she asked. She caught me off guard. My mind rattled through the possibilities. Guitar? Nah. The Music Academy definitely wasn't a Jimi Hendrix sort of place. Something small and manageable, like a flute maybe? That was too girly. "Violin," I said, unknowingly sealing my fate for the next decade or so. Somehow, out of nowhere, I had just been accepted into a world-class music school. I believe it was the first time my parents discovered their kid was special. Back at home, they asked me, "Why did you say you wanted to play the violin? None of us play it, and you've never in your life ever even held one." To which I replied, "Can you see me carrying a piano to school every day?" "I don't think so," I thought to myself, sarcasm that I would never say out loud to my parents. I had chosen one of the smallest instruments, which ended up being one of the hardest to learn. My logic was to try to make my life easier, but instead, I made it incredibly more difficult. Little did I know that the academy required piano study for all students, because piano was how we learned solfeggio, otherwise known as music theory. My beginning efforts were painful, both for me and for everyone else with ears in the vicinity. I've read that clinical physiologists have determined that out of all musical instruments, the violin is the closest in sound to a human voice, which is why it has such an eerie ability to trigger extreme depths of emotion. Listeners can hear the violin crying, but when they are subjected to the attempts of a 6-year-old beginner, innocent bystanders can feel like crying themselves. My sound fell somewhere between very bad singing and a cat being strangled. The rule was that I had to practice for an hour every day after school. Scales repeated endlessly easily qualify as among the most annoying sounds in the world. We were crowded into a 2-room apartment where my parents slept on the fold-out couch in the living room and where Max and I had our bunk beds in a tiny space nearby. so there was no place to run, no place to flee from my wretched practicing. Okay, you see where the clock is now? My parents, usually my mom, would ask. If you practice until 3, you can go outside and play. I could hear other kids in the courtyard having fun, and they could hear me inside playing scales. I kept one eye on the clock and one eye on the sheet music on the stand in front of me. To the T, to the minute, to the absolute second that 3 o'clock came, I dropped the violin as though it were on fire and rushed my ass outside to be a regular kid again. It didn't matter if I was in a mid-vibrato. When the big hand hit the 12, I was gone quicker than Usain Bolt at the 2016 Olympics. I wouldn't even bother to put the violin in this case. I'd just toss it on the bed and head right out. So what happened next was really my fault. I was outside after practice one day when I heard a surprise shout from inside our apartment. Apparently Max had been reading and was so focused on his book that he sat on my violin and crushed it. The instrument wasn't exactly a Stradivarius, but it was the local version of the best, costing a lot more than we could afford to spend. My parents were furious at the loss. Max caught an ass-whooping, and I tried my best to look as though I felt bad. "Aw, damn," I said mournfully, while really on the down low I was the happiest kid in the world, because the accident meant that practice would be put off indefinitely. But I underestimated my parents, because they came up with a new violin for me in 2 days. That's just the way they were. If you were their kid and you had committed to something, you had to live up to your responsibilities. Not only did I have to start practicing again after a short break, I was now sentenced to making up for the time I lost, practicing for 2 hours a day instead of one. After years of study, I finally came to believe that the ability to create music is almost a superpower. That's why I feel music education is so important for children. It doesn't matter whether they become a CEO, an insurance salesman, or a garbage man. It's important for kids to develop their passion palette, enthusiasms that will further their individuality and help them find happiness and fulfillment. There was music on the academy syllabus, obviously, but there was also classes in math, science, and language. It was a prestigious musical institution that still emphasized the fundamentals of learning. The glorious architectural monument of a building added a sense of romance to ordinary school days. I entered when I was 6 and remained for 2 years, leaving only when our family immigrated to the States. This was the first time that my path diverged from Max's, who attended a school focused mainly on math and science. I loved being there. Their academy had classes for 1st through 12th grade, and I would always hang out on the upper floors where the older high school students studied. I was up there so often they adopted me as a kind of little brother. Max was walking me to school one day, and we saw a pair of tough-looking 10th graders headed towards us. They looked menacing to him, and when he told the story later, my brother always emphasized how nervous he became. "Look at these two," he muttered to me. "We're definitely going to get jumped here." Before I could respond, the older kids broke out in smiles. "Hey, Val, what up?" They were friends from the upper floors of the music academy. "This is my brother Max," I said. "Nice to meet you," they responded, slapping me 5 as they headed on past. Walking away, I couldn't help teasing my brother. "I guess we didn't get a beat down after all, huh?" If I hadn't been such an empty-headed little kid during the incident, I might have realized that my relationship with Max was beginning to change. We were moving in different directions. Though I was a solid 10 inches shorter than my brother back then, I always packed a harder punch. Those were golden days, and way before ballroom dance, hip-hop, or Hollywood came into my life. I had already been deeply and permanently influenced by Adiesa Mama, a city that served as a third parent to me. When I finally got to America, no one understood where I was coming from. Friends I met in Brooklyn couldn't grasp it. In New Jersey, no one knew. And in West Hollywood, they definitely didn't know. People from Odessa are like people from New Orleans. We're proud of our heritage, and we speak differently, act differently, create differently. We infuse our conversation with comedy and sarcasm and jazz, and we carry our hometown with us everywhere we go. Immigrant. The decision to leave Odessa didn't come easily for my family. In recent times, there were essentially two waves of Russian immigration to America. The first came in the 1970s, when the government loosened the immigration rules for Jewish refuseniks, outcasts, poets, and activists who spoke out against the Soviet society. The second started when Mikhail Gorbachev opened the borders in early 1990s, officially ending totalitarian rule and giving independence to 14 Soviet republics, Ukraine being one of them. I hope that last development can help clear up how I could be a Russian coming from Ukraine. The USSR was like the US, in that it was made up of numerous supposedly separate but united states. Critics challenged that idea, saying, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, four words, four lies. In America, how many New Yorkers live in New Jersey? And how many New Jerseyans live in New York? In the same way, a lot of Russians lived in Ukraine. With the breakup of the Soviet Union, it was as if New Jersey had now been made a separate country. My father was in his late teens in the 1970s, and at that time he saw those who left simply as traitors, betraying their ideals of national pride and loyalty. He was always an idealistic man, especially in his youth. For him, the sentiment back then was, we're proud Russians, so we're going to stick it out no matter what. Years later, with the Russian economy thoroughly in the toilet, things were different. It was time to leave. Now my dad was a parent of two and no longer a kid in his teens. He left behind that prideful, patriotic, knee-jerk response in favor of a little more common sense. There's no opportunity here, and it's not a safe environment to raise the children. It has to be better somewhere else. That somewhere else was the United States of America. There's heaven, and right next door is America. And that's how Eastern Europeans looked at it. For anyone to dream about going to the States was a laughable ambition. Contrary to popular belief, it's really hard to get to come to America. The immigration authorities don't just hand out visas like red roses. My parents faced a tidal wave of doubt from others. Nah, you can't do it. And you won't survive. With the overwhelming odds against them, the chances appeared slim to none that they would be able to accomplish what they set out to do. How does anyone even begin the process of leaving? Imagine picking up everything you know, your entire life, your children's lives, the lives of your loved ones, and moving it all to the other side of the world, the most exclusive side, the place hardest to get into. And once you manage that impossible task, then what do? You don't speak English, you don't have any friends, you don't have a job. What then? How proud, how determined, how desperate, how strong did my parents have to be in order to look at that 40-foot tidal wave of negativity come straight at them and just buckle down and do it anyway? It took a lot of courage. They made a decision for which I'm still being paid dividends. The investment they made in us, allowing our incredible family to grow and prosper in a new land. So when you think about the person who is able to get up, drop everything that's comfortable, everything that they know and are used to, you have to understand that they face overwhelming odds. Once they're able to breathe out and settle in, the immigrant sure isn't feeling a sense of entitlement, but rather an immense deal of gratitude. The Thanksgiving holiday in our household has become like the 4th of July, observed more enthusiastically every single year. I celebrate family and America. Those two things are what I'm most grateful for in my life. My name will never say that proudly for me, but if you're willing to go beyond my impossible-to-pronounce last name and lend me your ear for a 5-minute conversation, you'll quickly realize that I'm as American as it comes. My pride for this country, which is ultimately reflected in my loyalty to it, is a prime example of what the flag stands for. In the classic "Who Asked You?" style of our family, I don't recall being consulted about the decision to leave Odessa. I was 7 years old and did have an opinion. The other family members could have asked me, but they didn't. I do remember a huge family dinner. It must have been in the spring of 1993 when the idea was first announced. Everything in our culture was a dinner thing. An hours-long combination feast, debate, and performance, with plenty of food and alcohol. The time spent around the dinner table was our Sunday church, our temple, synagogue, and mosque. We shared everything, all our thoughts and emotions, for better and for worse, accompanied by noisy interruptions and intense back and forths, all allowing us to wind up feeling united once again. The dinner table was where you made the big announcements, where the head of the house had to be the wise one, and where we learned the most, where we connected the most. This particular dinner, there was a lot of raw sentiments and more than a few tears. My father found himself looking at the same people he had been preaching to years before about loyalty to Russia. Those teenage ideals had caught up to him in the real world, not the imaginary world he had created for himself, influenced by Soviet propaganda. Now he was a grown man with a grown man's responsibilities. We can't stick it out, after all. My mom was different. She hadn't been preaching ideology in her teenage years. She had lifelong friendships, ones that she had always treasured and cared for. "Oh my God, we're leaving Odessa?" my mother moaned. But even with all those deep feelings, still, she signed on to the move. As an adult looking back, I stand in awe at my parents' resolve. These two people essentially said, "We are all in on each other and our kids. This is it. I'm all in as a father, and I'm all in as a husband. I'm all in as a mother, and I'm all in as a wife." I was sitting at the table, but I didn't have any chips to play. I was excited, but I had just turned 8 and was always in a state of perpetual excitement about something, anything, everything. "Okay, wow, leaving? That sounds exciting. Where are we going? What's happening? I think we should go right now." "Who asked you?" my entire family replied. Before we could leave Russia, the four of us had to trek up to the United States Embassy in Moscow to get our official exit documents. From Odessa, Ukraine, we traveled by train to the Russian capital. This was a 25-hour trip, and let me tell you, Russian railroads never prioritized the comfort of the customers. The bottom line was getting from point A to point B in the most stripped-down way possible. The conditions were cramped and the trip seemed endless. In Russia, there's an expression, "spat valetom," which literally translates to "sleep like jacks." When you are faced with the task of fitting a body on a single bed, say, or another piece of furniture that's obviously an impossible fit for two people, you spиш валетом. Валетом was a reference to валет, the jack in a suit of cards, a figure which faces up or down depending which way the card was held. Валетом meant to imitate that, where one person would sleep one way and the other one would sleep opposite. I guess the English equivalent might be 69, but I like спать валетом better. On that trip to Moscow, Max and I спали валетом, crammed onto a single bench seat, my face right next to his smelly feet. I found out that the process of emigrating wouldn't be so damn easy, at least not for me and my brother. Meanwhile, the adults were left standing for the whole day-long journey. One adult was always standing. My parents' sacrifice seemed to exist on a higher, finer level than the world of us kids. It might have been true everywhere, but I felt as though in the old country, my parents were always sacrificing, one day after another. Every day was about the struggle to survive. They were always symbolically standing on their feet in a crowded train. Unless you were a masochist, who was in love with pain and struggle, sooner or later you were going to decide that enough was enough. By the early 1990s, our family had reached that sort of tipping point, and it put us on the train to Moscow, seeking official permission to leave for America. My grandmother, my father's mom, had contacts with groups that gave aid to Jewish people leaving Russia, headed mostly to Israel, the States, or Canada, with some others going elsewhere in Europe or to Australia. Though we weren't observant and we were at best culturally Jewish, my father's passport had the word Jewish stamped across it, just like a yellow star of David would have identified him in the past. The same religious classification that had held my father in so many ways was now going to allow us to leave Russia. After that traumatic train journey, we arrived in Moscow to find the city locked in a civil war. Not a full-scale one, but there was a level of unrest that definitely put troops in the streets. We had landed smack in the middle of a constitutional crisis, with President Boris Yeltsin facing off with hardline communists in the parliament. My parents couldn't believe it. We could see the smoke rising from where tanks were shelling the parliament building. Of course, as a 7-year-old, I found the whole business terribly exciting. We survived getting strangled by Russia's horrible bureaucratic red tape, received our precious exit visas, and returned to Ukraine to pack up. The move to America felt permanent, as though we were leaving for another planet, as if the airlines flew only in one direction and there was no possible way to return. We got rid of anything we could possibly sell, until our old apartment was bare to the walls. Everyone around me wept. Thank God I was too young to cry. "My whole life I've lived here," my dad said. "My father's buried here. All of our friends are here, and I'm saying goodbye to all of that." At the end of May 1994, 2 months after I turned 8, we boarded an American Airlines flight to the U.S. with a single stopover in Shannon Island. As I stumbled off the airplane at JFK Airport in New York City, I recall my first impression was that the air smelled different. Not only that, but the colors seemed sharper, with a greater variation of shades than I was used to. The water from the water fountain tasted fresher than anything I had ever drank. It was a whole different level of life than what I'd experienced in Ukraine. I had heard one magic word whispered over and over. I thought, that must be what America smells and looks and tastes like. Freedom. From JFK, we went straight to Brooklyn, New York, to the home of relatives, the family of my grandmother's cousin, Garik, and his wife, Sveta. I had a son named Dima who had 2 boys, an older stepson, Damien, who was around Max's age, and a younger son, Brian, who was my age. A time-honored immigrant tradition required that those who came before host families who arrived later. But it stung a little to come to America, hat in hand, and join Dima, a sort of cousin who in Odessa my father had always considered something of an insignificant little punk. Dima had left Russia with his parents in 77 and was now a grown man, living in a 40-story building in Brooklyn neighborhood of West Brighton, and enjoying an established life in the States. It wasn't like he was a gazillionaire. There were no one percenters walking around these streets, but Dima was solidly middle class. I looked around and thought the whole arrangement was incredible. The towering apartment complex, the playground that was right on the grounds, the clean sidewalks, the green patches of lawn, and not a single broken down Zaporozhets in sight. But my life was about to get a whole lot better. In a little sort of ceremony over dinner on the evening of our arrival, my grandmother's cousin came forward. "Sveta has now a gift for you boys," my father announced to us in Russian. I could hear a slight sense of embarrassment in his tone, that a relative was about to give his sons something he was not able to afford. No one else would have detected that, but I knew my father better than most. It didn't matter. Max and I had entered into an American fairyland, where the surroundings seemed nicer, plusher, and richer than what we had back home. And here came Sveta, with a wide smile on her face, holding out 2 large cardboard boxes. We couldn't believe it. A safe place to land was enough of a prize, and now we were going to get presents? I eagerly opened my package with no expectations of what was inside. If the box had been empty, I would have still used it proudly, and likewise, if I had discovered gold bars, I wouldn't have been surprised. Instead, there was something better than gold. A pair of beautiful inline skates, black rollerblade lightnings, with dark purple laces and chrome fasteners. The model had been introduced just a few years before and had effectively revolutionized the sport. Its invention was the greatest single engineering feat ever in the history of mankind. Or so I thought. My 8-year-old head exploded. This was America. Right here, fresh off the boat, and right out of the box. The molded plastic off the boot cuffs appeared to come directly from the future. Or as it turned out, from a factory in China. I was too stunned to speak. "Do you have something to say to Sveta?" my father whispered, giving me a gentle cuff on the head. "Spasiba, spasiba," I cried out to our hosts, thanking them in Russian. Max got a pair too. Forget about the little booklets of cardboard with government stamps all over them. Those rollerblade lightnings were our true passports to the United States of America. In Ukraine, we had that old-style roller skates with 4 wooden wheels. Well, we didn't have them in our family, of course, but a few well-off people did. These rollerblades meant that Max and I had somehow blown right past the clunky old-fashioned roller skates and proceeded directly to the Rolls-Royce of inline locomotion. The next morning, we strapped on our blades and rumbled down the sidewalk to West Playground, a block-long recreational area that featured handball courts, exercise equipment, and swings. In other words, the place was typical local urban park. Nothing big, nothing fancy, just a place for kids and adults to gather. I remember being excited to be abroad in Brooklyn without grown-up supervision. We were discovering new terrain. Wobbling along like a pair of drunks, Max and I entered the park. He mastered the skates a little more quickly than I did and left me behind. We first passed an area where older people played chess, mostly Russian immigrants. We were going at a snail's pace, but it felt like we were flying. Talk about a pair of rookies. Beyond the chess players were the swings, hanging unused in the springtime sun. Then up a bit further on the right were the handball courts. I've since lived in several other cities in America, but Brooklyn is the only place where handball is a major, deadly serious street game. After handball came the basketball courts. Through the green, chain-link fences of the courts, we could see a sidewalk and another, smaller set of swings, all neglected and broken, making for a place where no kids would ever venture unless they happened to be well-armed. It was as if the area had a sign posted in front of it, "Shady shit happens here." I could already catch a whiff of dark, violent street energy. Max was 20 yards ahead of me. Before I knew what was happening, I saw 5 dudes surround him. They were shouting, although I didn't understand English, I knew they were roughing him up for the rollerblades. I remember seeing a pair of identical twins, heavyweight, Italian-American thugs leading the assault. I practically crapped myself. I was so terrified. I couldn't believe what was happening. Back in Odessa, I had been a devoted fan of an American television program called Rescue 911, hosted by Star Trek's Captain Kirk, William Shatner. The reality show portrayed police, fire, and paramedic units responding to real 911 emergency calls. The concept appeared magical to my young eyes. I had never witnessed anything remotely like it in Ukraine. Find yourself in trouble? Dial 911 and instantly, hordes of helpful, life-saving emergency personnel would descend upon the scene. At that moment at West Playground, I didn't have a phone handy. "I gotta get our pops," I told myself. I was too small and too far away to help my brother. The only thing I could think of to do was to turn around, wobble back up the street to the apartment building of my grandmother's cousin's son, and burst into the place bellowing out the familiar call I had seen on Rescue 911. "Call 911! Max is getting beat up! Call 911! My dad chose not to call 911, deciding instead on an immediate, more personal response, more Russian than American. He rushed outside wearing only his boxers and black socks, on a mission to save his 14-year-old son from getting mugged for a pair of brand new rollerblade lightnings. We met my brother at the gate of West Playground, walking back with his head in his hands, his t-shirt ripped and no skates. After I left to get help, the situation in the shady area beyond the basketball courts turned serious. One of the twins busted a bottle and sliced Max's shirt open. but by now the culprits were long gone. Welcome to America, in the most real way possible. Welcome to Brooklyn. Years later, my brother and I would go back to the old neighborhood every once in a while. Our grandmother, who had also immigrated to America, still lived in East New York. We had friends in the area, and we'd go out to Russian restaurants on Brighton Beach. Sometimes we'd make a detour to Avenue X and West Street, to the apartment building that was our first stop after arriving in America. Taking a trip down memory lane was inspiring and humbling at the same time. Growing up, I always felt like the neighborhood was Italian, and Schmerkovskis were just visitors. For that reason, I felt more comfortable around Black and Hispanic kids than I did around Italian kids and native Brooklynites. They were the ones who were always calling out, "Go back to fucking Russia." They were the ones who had a sense of entitlement to any outdoor space they wanted to claim. The minority kids I knew were like me, a bit like strangers in a strange land. On one of those nostalgia trips back to the hood, Max and I could see how the place had changed from a mostly Italian enclave to a Russian one. The Russian immigrants were the alpha dogs now, the dominant ones. It was the old story of American transformation. Visiting brought up a lot of emotions. I remember that on our first Halloween, after we moved into our apartment, we had our windows egged. It wasn't directed at us personally, but it was intimidating at first, until a couple of years later we stepped out and started throwing eggs ourselves. When we came back from our mission, our mom was furious. "You wasted all our eggs?" she wailed. Nostalgia was a blade that cut both ways. Going back, remembering was always bittersweet. We were living in New Jersey by the time of this particular visit back to Brooklyn, and on our way home, Max wanted a bottle of water. We pulled up at a key food supermarket on Avenue Z, a few blocks away from the West Playground. I guess not all the forget-about-it guys had moved out of the neighborhood, because there was one of the Italian twins right there, the former skate thief, grown older and heavier. He was bagging groceries in the checkout line. I don't think the twin recognized us. If revenge is a dish best served cold, this one was frozen solid. But I have to wish for you the same kind of sweet payback and hope that you encounter one of your childhood bullies later on in life, bagging groceries as a supermarket checkout boy. Every family has its own library of stories, accounts of this or that incident, a funny response to what someone said, a shared memory to treasure. Max and I bonded over our Welcome to America stolen rollerblade saga. You may have run across it before because we've told it often enough on talk shows and in media interviews. At the time, what happened was traumatizing, but it's a very comfortable story by now. We grew up and carried it with us, a shared lesson learned from a childhood experience. School. Odessa to Brooklyn represented a huge, head-twisting transition for all of us in the family. Due to the rollerblades incident, Max and I had been put on notice that we had to watch our shit, step up our game a bit, figure out how to negotiate around the obstacles and pitfalls of the brave new world we had been dropped into. But my mom and pops had steep learning curves too. We had people in Milwaukee and could have moved out there. Nothing against Wisconsin and the Midwest, but I can't imagine how different my life would have been if my parents had taken that route. New York City is the life for me, my true home, full of energy and possibility and excitement. Even today, whenever I stay for long stretches in LA, somewhere in my heart I rest easy with the knowledge that the city is just a plane ride away. In Brooklyn, the Chmerkovsky family was no longer surrounded by people who looked like us, sounded like us, and lived like us. We were now trying to survive amid huge numbers of other immigrants from all over the world. As much of a melting pot as Odessa had been, Brooklyn was on a whole different level. Just to walk down the block meant I'd hear maybe a half dozen different languages, with countless heritages represented. African American, Italian, Puerto Rican, Dominican, Cuban, Russian, Polish, Indian, Pakistani, Arab, Muslim, Albanian. It was New York City, man. To my young ears, all of the voices sounded Italian. Jewish, Russian, Latino, it didn't matter. Everyone had an Italian accent, which meant excessive swearing, excessive fronting, and an excessive display of that alpha dog survival instinct.